Welcome back. Night number three. As we get started, so the first two evenings were basically spent working through the text of the story. For those of you who have been here for both, or for one, or for neither, we went through the story, the verses of the Garden of Eden, raised a whole bunch of questions, and now we have the exciting task of trying to put some of these questions, you know, after Humpty Dumpty falls off the wall, now you got to put them back together. So it's easy and a lot of fun to ask a lot of questions, and now we have the difficult part of coming up with some answers. So the introduction that I will give will be as such that there has been so much written on this topic. This subject, this is such a primary, fundamental topic of the very first sin of mankind and the ramifications, as we learned, the difficulty of childbirth, the fact that man has to work the land by the sweat of his brow to provide for his sustenance, the snake's curse. There's so much here, the expulsion from the Garden of Eden, which was apparently we were supposed to have been, the shift from the form of tree sustenance to the type of now bread sustenance. It's a fundamental story. There has been much ink spilled over the generations trying to answer. I am not going to claim to present the answer that will answer every single question. We'll be left with still a bunch of questions, but this is an approach. We will go through an approach. We will have some questions left at the end, but hopefully we'll have a lot answered, and we will certainly have a new insight into what we have already studied. So let's see where it takes us, and let's begin. All right, let's start with the serpent. The questions we had asked regarding the serpent, which were introduced in the beginning of chapter 3, the big elephant in the room regarding the serpent is, where is the serpent coming from? What is his agenda? What does he want out of this story? All of a sudden the serpent comes in, he's trying to tempt Eve to eat of the fruit. Why? Why does he care? What does he stand to gain in doing so? So let's start with the statement from the sages that many of you had already mentioned. The sages say that the serpent desired to marry Eve, so he was hoping to assassinate Adam, that Eve would give the fruit to Adam, Adam would die, and then he would have Eve all to herself. So that's sort of on the table. That basically raises more questions than it answers. What exactly do the sages mean when they say something like that? But let's just put that back on the table as we did last night as part of our problems. To introduce the problem of the serpent, let's go back to the concept of nakedness. We discussed last night that nakedness seems to weave its way throughout the story. It's in the very beginning, the first time we're introduced to man and his wife. They were naked and they were not ashamed. The first thing they notice upon eating of the fruit is that they are now naked. The first thing that man says to God when God approaches him and says, "Why are you hiding?" He says, "I'm afraid because I am naked." And then when they're expelled from the garden, God provides them with clothing so that they should not be naked. Over and over again, it runs itself through. There was one more nakedness in this story, which a couple of you have mentioned to me, that we have not yet really addressed. And that is the nakedness of the serpent. Where do we see the nakedness of the serpent? So you have to look on the Hebrew side for this one. If you're going to look on the English, you'll never find it. But on the Hebrew side, when we're introduced to the serpent, in the beginning of verse 1 in chapter 3, the Hanachash Haya Arum Mikol Chayos Hasadeh, the serpent was... Now this is translated as cunning, which is what it means, but the same word for cunning is the same word which also means naked. If you look back in the Hebrew side of the previous verse, chapter 2:25, when we describe man and his wife as being naked, what word do we use? Vayushinehem arumim. They were both naked. Now the Torah chooses in two consecutive verses to use the exact same word, which happens to be a word which weaves its way through the entire story. Whenever the Torah does that, it's obviously pointing you towards something and saying, this is important. Even though we're going to define the snake as being cunning, we're going to choose the word to mean naked. Another instance of being naked, used directly after describing man and his wife as being naked, we describe the snake as being naked, even though we're using it in the context of really being cunning. Now, on a simple level, the snake we can actually define as being naked because, as we mentioned last night, of all the mammals that live on earth, he doesn't have, as part of the reptile kingdom, he doesn't have fur or hair. So he a little bit is naked. But let's assume the term means something a little bit deeper than that. Let's be conceptually for a second. What does it mean if I say that someone is acting naked? Not just physically naked, but they're acting naked. What would that mean?
They're not hiding.
They're not hiding anything exactly. They're exposed. What you see is what you get. It's just me, myself, and I. Nothing covering, nothing hiding me. Now, we don't like that. That's why we cover ourselves up with clothing. We put masks on Purim, which is a whole other discussion about how we hide the inner essence of things. We flip things on their head. But being naked is a concept of being entirely exposed. What's the relationship between the meaning of the word naked and the meaning that we use here of cunning? What does it mean to be cunning?
Sly.
To be sly.
Sneaky.
To be sneaky. It's the exact opposite of being naked. You're hiding something. When I am being cunning, I'm showing something, but it's not really my agenda. I'm being sly about it. I'm being sneaky, hidden. Isn't that interesting that the Torah uses the word to define the snake as being arum, which means naked, when it's trying to tell us he's being cunning. Those are opposites, being naked and being cunning. And yet the Torah uses the same word, which leads us to think that in some way, when the snake was being cunning as he is trying to tempt Eve, at the same time, from a different perspective, he might actually be just naked and straightforward. And somehow in his argument, we're going to try to find where he's being both sneaky, sly, and totally open and straightforward at the same time. Because the Torah uses that same word, naked, to describe his cunningness, and it's such a classic word that's used so often. Let's see what we can get. Let's see what we get with this snare. Where is the beginning of the story with the serpent? Where would we say, if you had to... And now, I think I mentioned this before. Where do we get the chapter headings? Chapter 2, chapter 3. Where did that come from? It comes from the Christians. When the Christians printed the first Bible, they needed to somehow label it with titles and chapters and all sorts of headings. So they created the system of chapter 1, verse 1, chapter 1, verse 2, and so on and so forth, until they decided to create chapter 2. And then they went through until they got chapter 3. Now, it's a fascinating study. We do not find anywhere in the sages or anywhere in Jewish tradition such a breakdown. We have parshas. Every week gets a parsha. And there are spaces in between paragraphs. That's where we find how the sages, based on what the Torah itself does, divide up. But not with this chapter and verse business. That's from the Christians, which has made its way in, and now that it's there, it's there. But that's not based on the sages. So if we had to put verse 1 in the story of the serpent, where would we put it? Now, I'll say it's an obvious choice why the Christians chose what they did, because this is the opening verse describing him. The end of the previous chapter described the man and woman. They were created, they were naked and not ashamed. And then we go into what seems to be an entirely new story. The serpent approaches her and tries to get her to eat of the fruits. New story, new chapter, new verse. But if we have to place the beginning of this story, and we're left with the question, what's the snake's agenda? What does he want? Well, if the Torah leaves that, is that a fair question to ask? Should we be entitled to ask, what in the world does the snake want out of here? I think so. Right? It's like this is too important a story not to be able to ask that question. Well, does the Torah not tell us? How could the Torah not tell us that question? Well, maybe it did. And it's actually so obvious from the text that the Torah didn't feel the need to explicitly state it. But if you look back, you'll find it. What takes place right before we're introduced to the serpent? Okay, keep going back. I'll give you a hint. It has to do with animals. Adam is naming all the animals. Why is Adam naming all the animals?
To find
a helpmate. God said, it's not good that man should be by himself. He needs a spouse. Now, you and I agree, what we would have done at that point is we would have created Eve, because we're God, and we know what man needs, so we would have just created that which he needed, and we would have said, man needs a spouse. Here, Eve, yours should be for Adam. But that's not what God does. Instead, what does he do? Parades all the animals before him and says, name them. And as we discuss naming, it means understanding its essence, what it is. And at the end of naming every single animal, the Torah says, and man could not find for himself a helpmate. Which means, what was he looking for? A helpmate. And he couldn't find one. And then God finally says, okay, let's create Eve. And in the backdrop of this, the most cunning of the animal kingdom walks, talks, likes good food, is intelligent, looks a whole lot like a human being, approaches Eve and wants something from her. What do you suppose he's after? He wants to say, one more chance. Wait a minute. I'm the best the animal kingdom has to offer. I'm the most cunning, most intelligent, walking, speaking, good food eating creature out there. Give me one more chance. You men are about to say you're rejecting the animal kingdom. Now let's go back to the very first word, verse that we learned together. Man was created and God breathed into him the breath of life. What day was this in the 6 days, 7 days of creation?
Six.
Who else was created on day six?
Animals.
How long did man exist as a living being, yet not yet endowed with his soul? But it was a significant period of time. Nachmanides and Ramban wrote, that didn't happen instantaneously. It wasn't some Frankenstein experiment where he formed man and immediately breathed into him. He existed as an animal-like creature for a significant amount of time and then was endowed with his soul and became what we would call a human being. So something was exalted out of the animal kingdom. God says, you will now rule over the animal kingdom. You will now be endowed with the spirit of myself, of your soul, which will give you the capacity to have intellect. You will be above, greater than them. You will rule over them. And you are unique amongst my creations in that realm. And to show you, Adam, I'm going to have you experience every animal and see if you can find for yourself a helpmate. See if you can find something. And he goes through all of them and he rejects them. He's experienced them. He's known each of them intimately and said, I understand you and you are not for me. And then God says, fine, now that you've experienced that you're different than the animal kingdom, which we're going to get back to because this is our main struggle. We have two parts of the human being, the animal part and the human part. But man has now rejected the animal part and said, not for me. I'm above that, different that. I rule over that. God says, now that you understand that, let me create for you your helpmate. Here is Eve. And in the next verse comes and says, and the snake was the most cunning of the animal kingdom and steps into the equation. What is his agenda? Abshamshon Raphael Hirsch, the great German rabbi of the previous century, says this is his agenda. One more chance, man, Adam. One more chance. You think Eve is so special that she's only unique for you? Listen to the words of the sages. The snake wanted to assassinate Adam and marry Eve. What is that saying? You think you're so special, Adam, that only you are entitled to have an Eve, a special creation, unlike any creation? God didn't create any other being out of the ribs of man to say, this is special, unique for man, different than the animal kingdom. Comes along the sages and they say, this is where the snake is after. He's going to show Adam, I'll get rid of you, and I'll marry Eve. Not literally talk, it's an argument here saying, what makes you so great that you're going to rule over us in the animal kingdom? What makes you think you're so special? I want another chance to show that I'm sort of on par with you. Now listen to the argument that he makes according to Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch. What are the words that he says to entice Eve? What's his opening line? Now remember we said he's cunning, right? So we would expect a cunning argument. What does he say? Even though Hashem said, do not eat of any of the trees of the garden, that he sort of trails off into, even though he said, don't do it, sounds like he's saying, but just do it anyway. Not a very cunning argument, right? Even though God said, don't do it, do it. It sounds like a sort of third grade kind of argument. It says of Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, put the emphasis in his statement in a different part of the sentence. Even though God said, don't eat it, even though he said those words, even though he commanded you, who cares that he said those words? Eve, look at it. Do you want it? Is it tempting to you? Would you like to eat it? Who do you think put those desires inside of you? Who created the feeling that you want to do something? Wasn't that God? Doesn't God create those feelings within us? Says the snake, according to Shamshon Fuller, the following argument. Does God speak to the animal kingdom?
No.
Well, yes and no. He doesn't speak to them with words, but does God communicate to the animal kingdom? Absolutely. How does he communicate to the animal kingdom? Exactly. with instinct, with their inborn traits, their desires, their natural tendencies are all an expression of godliness. The way God created the natural world around us. When a grizzly bear goes salmon fishing in an Alaskan river and rips the salmon out of the water and eats it, do we call it brutal? Is it a murderer? Or is it expressing the beauty of God's natural world? When a lion runs down a poor helpless zebra that's not as fast as its colleagues and rips it to shred for dinner. So we might look at it and say, like, ooh, that was gruesome. But in reality, what is that? Is that not an... Why did the lion do that? Because it was hungry, right? How did the lion know that what it's supposed to do is track down a zebra and eat it for dinner? Because that's how it was created. And we can actually sing songs, as the Psalms do regularly, Perek Shira, sing the songs of the animal world, how they sing praises to God in the way that they're fulfilling that God-giving instinct that they were given. Says the snake, you have such an interesting dilemma, Eve. I've never had this before. You have a feeling inside. You'd like to eat of this fruit. It looks good, right? Pleasing to the eye. Who told you you can't eat it? God did. Okay, so on the one hand, he spoke to you and told you not to eat it, but don't you want to do it? Who put that inside of you? Who gave you that desire? God. What an interesting contradiction. God's desire that he placed within you tells you to do one thing, and then he uses his words to tell you something the opposite of that. Well, let me tell you something, Eve, says the snake. If you were a snake, if you were in the animal kingdom, you know how you would resolve that? You'd eat it. Because in the animal kingdom, the way God communicates to us is through our natural inborn instinct. Even though God said, don't eat of the fruit, says the snake, do it anyway. Because who says his words are more powerful than his instinct? Remember, this is the first man ever created. This is the first time man's ever been given a verbal command that contradicts those inner desires. Says the snake, be part of our world, Eve. What makes you guys think you're so different and so much better? We ask, what differentiates the serpent from the human? They both walk. They both talk. They're both intelligent. They both like good food. They both know how to be cunning. They look very similar. Well, you know what might distinguish them? How does God talk to you? If he talks to you through your inner inborn desire, well, then you're an animal. If he talks to you through words and tells you, listen to me and be above those inborn desires, well, then you're a human. Now, if Foreman writes, he was once in New York City listening to the radio as he was driving through town, and there was the talk show host was discussing the concept of abstinence, whether or not people should or should not be abstinent before getting married. And so one caller calls in and was a big proponent of abstinence, and he presented a religious argument. He said, it is clear that God wants us to be abstinent until we get married. So the host says, okay, buddy, listen. Do you have any desires? So there's the silence, he writes, on the other end of the phone. This is on the air. So the host waits an appropriate amount of awkward silence and says, of course you do. You're just like the rest of us. And then the disc jockey says to the guy, in a religious response to his religious argument, said, who do you think put those desires in you? Isn't it God? Why do you suppose God would have done that if not for you to act upon it? Now the poor caller was way overmatched and had no response. And our foreman writes, I'm sitting in my car, this is in the 1990s in New York City, thinking, oh my goodness, the snake is alive and well. That's the argument. How does God communicate? Does he communicate through your inner desires and whatever you feel you do? That's how an animal functions. Or is he communicating in a way that says, I know you want this, and in fact, I'm the one who created the desire within you to want it, but I am telling you with words, don't do it. And I've given you instructions. And the snake's opening line, as he questions the supremacy of man, who is now created on the same day, who's been exalted above the animal status to rule over the animal kingdom, who can't find a mate from all of these animals and needs a special creation, comes along the snake and says, not so fast, one last chance. Hold on. Eve, don't you want it to be like us? Be like us. take that desire that you have and act on it. Eat it because you want it. And that's godly, he's going to argue. Even though God said, don't eat it, do it anyway because you want it. That is how Rav Shamshon Rafalberg understands this argument of the snake. Hold on, we've got lots to do, so I'm going to hold off on questions right now. Now, he does one other thing when he makes this argument, as we pointed out. He doesn't say, even though God said, don't eat of that tree, what does he really say?
Any
of the trees. He makes it much larger, much more difficult than it really was. Even though God said, you can't eat from anything, don't you? That's already planting a seed of taking that which was prohibited versus the whole world which was permitted. And he's already beginning to plant those seeds of everything is really prohibited. This is a really big task that God is asking you, monumental in scope. And don't you want it? It is impossible that you could not act on these desires that you have. Let's go back, and now Eve is going to go through this battle. What was life like before eating? We all know what life is like after eating. We live it every day. Let's go back. What was it like to be Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden before eating of the tree? One of the questions do we have to address. They had some form of a test. They were given a command, and they could either have kept it or disobeyed it. What would it have been like? Or more appropriately, what was the test? What was the trait that they needed to exert in the Garden of Eden in their decision process, their decision-making process of either eating or not eating?
Self-control.
What's that?
Self-control.
So let's define that a little bit more. The Rambam, Maimonides, writes as follows. We discussed that clearly if man was given a command and he was told to observe it, he must have had some form of a moral compass. You have man, he's created, God says, don't eat of the tree. I have to have some form of knowledge of right from wrong if I'm given a command and I'm accountable that I'm going to be punished if I don't observe it. Which means I have some form of a moral compass beforehand, and then that's going to change when I eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. That's what we're left with, defining what was it like before. And what is it like after? What is knowledge of good and evil like? And what is that different from whatever it was before? So Maimonides takes the following approach. This is in his Mor Nevuchim. He writes, the word that we would use to describe man's moral compass before eating would be the words of emes and sheker, truth and falsehood. That was the world in which Adam lived. He lived in a world of truth and falsehood. For example, 2 + 2 = 4. Is that true or is that good?
It's true.
Why is that true or not good?
There's no moral value.
Right? And no moral value, it's just objective. It just is. 2 + 2 = 4. If I say I am standing in New York right now, false or bad?
False.
Just false. It's just an objective fact. It just is. It's not true. Not bad. It may be bad, it may not be bad, we can talk about that, but it is false, right? It's just not true. Says Maimonides, Adam and Eve living in the Garden of Eden lived in a world where their moral decisions was as clear as truth and of falsehood. They knew clearly this is what's correct and it's true. The decision to steal, if you were to ask Adam, is stealing bad or is it false? He would answer that question by saying, it's false, because it's against God's will, and that which is against God's will, the way that he would understand that would simply be as objectively real as we say, I'm in New York, that's false. It's not a debate, it's nothing to talk about good, bad, it's just not true. God's will and desire for man had that same quality of being clearly, it's just false. Stealing is not bad, it's false. It's sheker. Keeping God's commands would be just truth. It's just emes. Now, if I were to ask you the following question, just because we're going to develop this a little bit. If I had a magic pill, and with the powers invested in me standing in this room, I would be able to split the ceiling, split the heavens, and you would have a one-moment chance to glance directly up to God, and you would see clearly, beyond a shadow of a doubt, his reality. Something which none of us have experienced, but I'm going to do that for you. I'm going to create a brief couple of seconds where I will split the heavens open, you will have a chance to peer up and you will see and perceive with absolute clarity that there is a God. Now, you don't have to answer this question, but I'm going to ask it to you anyway. Do you think that you would then keep all the commandments as you currently understand them without ever veering from them?
No.
I just showed you God. You saw clearly. There is no more doubt. There's no questions. There are no more late night discussions. There is a God. There isn't a God. It's done. It's over. You have seen clearly, and that vision is indelibly imprinted in your mind. You will always remember it. Do you still think you will sin?
Yes.
Why?
Because we always, it's not a question of sinning now, whether we believe or not believe in God. We believe in God, and we still sin. So even if we feel what's going on up there,
So the Ramban, Nachmanides writes as follows. After the giving of the Torah on Har Sinai, the Jews are all standing there, the Ten Commandments have been revealed, and the Jewish people all just saw God. They heard from Him directly. The Torah says, Moshe speaks to the people who were clearly frightened at that time. Al tira'u, do not be afraid, Moshe says to them, ki v'va'avor na'sos haskan. In order to test you, Hashem has come and appeared to you. In order to test you, He has come and appeared. Says Ramban, well, He just appeared, so now He has removed, in His language, milavavam kol safek. There is no doubt. There is not a single person that exists amongst the Jews who have any doubt. They are clear, and they could all write Rabbi Akiva textbooks themselves. They see clearly. They know everything. What's the test? Says the Ramban, I still want to see whether or not you love me, and if you desire to do my will, if you will still keep my will. What power within us is that which says, even when I know what's right and what's true, that I still don't want to do it? I don't want the fancy Hebrew words. What is it when you're walking by a park bench and you see a sign, you're strolling along and it says, wet paint. And you are overcome by the desire to touch it. Why? Because wet paint really says, don't touch. And when we are told, don't touch, we say, you're telling me what to do? Absolutely not. I'll show you. And we'll touch it. And we don't care if anyone's looking or not looking, and we don't even care if it's wet. Because that sign says, don't touch. And we don't like being told what to do. It's a koach of merida, of rebellion, that says, you're telling me what to do? I don't like that. The godliness within our soul, our human condition, one of the primary forces that we have to contend with is always rebellion against authority. We don't like it. Human beings don't like it. We like to rebel. We like to be our own autonomous, creative creatures who are in charge of ourselves and will determine what to do. And God gives man one commandment in Gan Eden. We ask, why would He create a tree just to forbid it to Adam? Well, there's something very fundamental in the fact that there was something forbidden to Adam in Gan Eden. That was what the Ramban points out, what the Jewish people have to experience even at Har Sinai, even after they saw clearly, and they knew, without a shadow of a doubt, there is God. He just spoke to me. Yet there's still a test. There's still a test of, now that you know, but will you listen? Will you accept my rulership? Will you accept that I am the King and your Maker, and I have created you, and these are my responsibilities that I have placed upon you? And as a human being, and Adam and Eve had this struggle, even with the clarity of knowledge that they had, will they or won't they abide by the rules? As the Rambam puts it, they saw clearly what was out there. It was not a matter, it was clear, this was right, this was wrong. That's clear. This is MS, this is truth, and this is Sheker, and this is falsehood. What's the struggle? But will I accept that I still have to abide by that which I see clearly as on the side of falsehood? This is on the side of Sheker, but it's still a struggle. It's always that struggle that we as human beings always have when anyone tells us what it is to do, because we, as I mentioned, do not particularly like dealing with that. Now, Eve is in Gan Eden. She's being approached by the serpent. The serpent is attacking her based on the supremacy of man. Man is different. Man hears commands, and the snake says, "But Eve, don't you want it? Doesn't it look good? Did God command you not to eat of any of them?" Now, if you remember when Eve responds, she has a whole bunch of differences in her response than the way that it was actually commanded. And they all shift focus of the way that God either permitted things, and she changes that, or the way that He forbade it. We're going to get back to that in a moment. But let's go back to what she sees after the dialogue. How does the Torah describe what she's looking at after their dialogue in verse 6? She saw the tree was good for eating. It was a delight to the eyes, and the tree was desirable as a means to wisdom. All levels of different levels of pleasures we discussed last night. On the most basic level, to eat. On a more sublime level, to look at. On a much more refined level, even just to think about a tree that's dripping with pleasure. And the snake is telling her, "Don't you want it? Wouldn't you like to eat of it?" And she goes ahead and partakes. Let's go through what happens now. She went from a world in which she had truth and falsehood in front of her, needing to choose which way she was going to go. Will she accept the rule? Will she not accept the rule? And I would almost add, parenthetically, in Eve's world, the rule that she was given was the first, what we would call Torah Shebal Peh, was the oral law. Because remember, who did she hear this commandment from? From Adam. She did not hear it directly from God. She wasn't in existence when God gave the initial command. She's hearing it from Adam. And now she's got to deal with, I hear this command from Adam, from God, and the snake is telling me, but hey, pay attention to those desires that you have inside, because those are also godly. I have these godly desires, and Adam telling me that I'm not allowed to do it, and she goes ahead and she eats. Now, what does she eat from? What is she from? She's from a tree of knowledge of good and evil. Tov v'ra, literally good and bad, good and evil, of knowledge. Now, what is the word das? Tree of knowledge. Where is the word das? How is the word das used in the Torah? The word das is always used as a form of intimacy or intimate knowledge of something. The way that the Torah describes man and his first instance of intimacy with his wife Eve is vayeda Adam eschav ishto. He knew her. The biblical phrase of our story, he knew her. What he knew? Because the level of das, of knowledge, implies a very intimate knowledge of a personal experiential experience with whatever it is that you're coming to know. In the instance that we have here of the tree, das tov v'ra means a intimate understanding of good and bad. Tov v'ra. Now let's work this through as we're going to switch from a world of emes and sheker, of truth and falsehood, to a world of good and bad. Let's start with the following simple example. Two kids are eating strawberry ice cream. One kid takes a spoonful and says, "Yum, this is great." The other kid takes a spoonful and says, "Yuck, this is bad." When they use those words, this one said it was very good, this one said it was very bad. What are they saying? I couldn't make out any words, but I assume what you said were, the one who says it's good is saying, "I like it," and the one who's saying it's very bad is saying, "I don't like it." That's how we use those words. The child who says broccoli is bad is not discussing the nutritional value of broccoli. The child who's saying broccoli is bad is saying, "I don't really like it." Ice cream is good is saying, "This, I do like." Now, to further go through this, I just quickly pass these around. This is just for the sake of hopefully clarifying as I speak the questions. Let's go through some moral dilemmas. This is going to be to hopefully just clarify and flesh out this idea as we go through. On the bottom of this page, as it works its way around, are four moral dilemmas. These are, the farmer himself created these four things. Let's work them through as we try to understand a little bit more that which is going on. Let's go through the bottom four dilemmas. One of these four is fundamentally different than the other three. And what I'd like to work through is let's see if we can come to a conclusion as to which one of these four is fundamentally different. Case number one, 4A, you have a dying man who's suffering terribly. And you're the only person in charge of his care who has the authority to make a decision, and he says to you, please, I beg of you, I'm in horrific pain, I've lived a full life, 90 years old, please pull the plug on me, I cannot take this suffering anymore. And you are now faced with the decision to pull the plug as per his request, or to keep him alive as per your understanding of the value of life. Moral dilemma number one, I'm not looking for answers to these dilemmas. I want to categorize them, which one of these following four is different. That's dilemma number one, to pull the plug or leave him on the respirator. Number two, your elderly mother needs help organizing her house before she moves, and my child needs me to help her prepare for finals. With whom do I spend the evening? I have one Sunday evening. I had been planning on doing one or the other, and I planned on spending it with my kid, helping him prepare for his Monday morning final. Sunday afternoon at 6, my mother calls and says, I didn't finish packing. I really need your help. I can't do it by myself. I can only do one. Who do I go to? What do I do? How do I handle that? Number three, Billy is taking a test, and he sees his good friend Tom peeking over his shoulder, cheating off of Billy's test. As Billy hands in the paper, his teacher says to him, hey Billy, I noticed, it looked to me like Tom was cheating off of your paper. Was he cheating? And Billy's now caught. Should he rat on his friend? Should he tell the truth to his teacher? What should he do in that circumstance? And situation number four, it's a dark and rainy night in Manhattan. Some of you have been waiting for this case because that was on the topic. Dark and rainy night in Manhattan, you throw your Suburban into reverse and hear the sickening thud behind you. A shiny new Lexus convertible sports car got a dented front end. Streets entirely dark, not a soul to be seen, and you're now faced with that classic dilemma, do I leave the note, do I not leave the note? Here you have our four moral dilemmas. Dying man asking you, begging you to take him off his respirator, do you not? Duty help your mother, your child? Should Billy lie to the teacher to protect his friend? And case number four, leaving the note in your dark and rainy night in Manhattan. One of these four is fundamentally different than the others. Anyone, let's go through. I did this on Shavuos night. The room is evenly divided between the four cases. Anyone feel it's number first case, the dying man, is fundamentally different? One volunteer, why? Yeah.
Because that's making a God-like decision.
Okay, that's playing God. In other words, I have...
The others are moral dilemmas, but that's playing God.
Okay, I don't know if you all agree to that reasoning or not, but in the interest of time, we'll go with one for each. Anyone hold the second case was the one that's fundamentally different? Yeah. Why?
Well, what
was it going to justify? Anyone want to justify it? Okay, we'll let you take the fifth on that one. Okay, anyone hold the third one? Billy lying to his teacher was the one that's fundamentally different. No one on that one? And the fourth one? Yeah, why?
Because in the fourth one, he actually did something by himself, and he did it by himself.
I did something wrong. I'm the one who hit the car.
There's
no witness, and I'm the one who did it wrong.
Right.
Okay, excellent. So interesting. So a couple of A's, a couple of D's, and a few in the middle, but not many. Okay. As we work through this, I want to give you two examples which happened, just to show you how common this is. Two things which happened to me just either today or yesterday, the following two scenarios. You be the judge of the following scenario. You be the rabbi. I got the following question. Somebody asked me this, and you tell me what you feel the answer should be. First thing over to me, young couple, they generally live in Israel, so their insurance plan is one of those international types of insurance plans with a very large deductible. And he was telling me something which had happened to him months before, but it came up again. Months ago, he'd been somewhere in the States, and either he, his wife, his kid, somebody needed to see a doctor or a specialist in something. They went to see him, and the charge was, I think he said about $150, like a $2,000 deductible, $150 charge. And the doctor said to him, or it was his nurse, I don't remember, it doesn't matter, they happened to have known each other, they knew the type of plan that he was on, and they said, oh, this kind of plan, your deductible is huge, you'll never meet it, let me write you a bill for $300, as if my charge is for $300, even though you're only going to pay me $150, I'll charge you $300, I'll forgive you the $150, and then you can have a receipt for $300, so that when you turn it into your insurance company, you're that much closer to your deductible. Rabbi, am I allowed to do that? What do you guys say? Is there anyone here who thinks you're allowed to do that? Can anyone here even think of a possible reason why that would be permitted? Anything out there? All right, maybe you can come up with something like that. Insurance, but I mean, from a moral perspective, is there a possible reason out there that you can? Right, but I'm saying from our perspective, is there a possible reason you can justify this? No, right? Is that clear? The person who asked me this was an intelligent, morally sound person. Why was he unclear that he felt he needed to ask me, hoping to get a response, when it seems so obvious to us? Right? Because he is involved. It's his $150 that's at stake. And when it's your issue, all of a sudden, that which was clear to you guys becomes a little bit more clouded. He at least felt he needed to ask a question, even though if he would have thought about it really hard, it's a ridiculous question. But he asked, like, a real question. Rabbi, this is the following scenario. What do you think? Like, I don't understand. What's the question? You don't have to do that. But it was a question. This morning, example number two, I'm heading down to from the office downstairs to the Beis Medrash, where I learn every morning. In my hand is my bowl of cereal, which I spend a lot of time making as healthy as possible. I have my Raisin Bran, I cut up strawberries and washed blueberries. I throw in, I'm going to have a healthy breakfast, very important to me. As I'm walking down with my bowl of cereal in my hand, on the counter, as I walk in, there's this big plate. What's my favorite cookie? No, Windsor cookies. There's big plates of fresh bakery Windsor cookies and a big bottle of schnapps sitting on the counter. Yeah. You say, what is that doing there? So today was the yard site of some Rebbe. I don't know, I remember his name. So one of the local fellows in the Beis Medrash decided to recognize that this was the day that he had passed away. And why do we do that, by the way? Why do people put out food on the day of someone's yahrzeit? Because if you make a bracha, the food, and you're only making it because it was in honor or merit of such a person, so then that person who's passed on will receive the merit of, look at what he's brought. Even after he has passed on, he is still bringing more holiness into this world, where therefore people are making blessings because in his merit. So it's a common thing that people will put out food. It doesn't have to be schnapps at 8 o'clock in the morning, but they'll put out food, cookies, cakes, fruit, something, with a little sign, this is the person who's passed away, please make a bracha in their merit. So I walk past, and I have the Windsor cookies staring me in the face. Now the schnapps, I'm no interest in that, but the Windsor cookies are a different story. But I'm holding my bowl of cereal with my strawberries and my blueberries and my whole bran, oats, and everything. And I look at it and I say, I'm hungry. I haven't eaten breakfast yet. And I say, oh, that stuff is poison. I'm not going to eat it. And I go sit down and I sit on it for an hour and a half. Now, an hour and a half later, I've long since finished my cereal. And I'm now walking back, and now I walk past it going the other way, and I don't have a bowl of cereal in my hand, and I'm still hungry, long having finished my bowl of cereal. What do I say to myself as I pass the cookies? No, better than that. I'm doing a mitzvah. I said to myself, I'm doing a mitzvah. That's exactly what I said to myself. And as I'm devouring my cookie, I can't believe that just happened. It's amazing. On my way in, I have my own food. I'm not hungry, and I'm able to see it for what it is. I really don't need these cookies. It's just, I don't need it. Because I got my bowl of cereal right in my hand. On the way back when I'm hungry, and I don't have an alternative, I actually not just justified, oh, just one. I made it into a mitzvah. I said, the man really needs my milk. I mean, I'm going to make a bracha. It's going to be amazing. And that's what it says, Rabbi Foreman, as he introduces, based on the Rambam, a world of good and bad, of tov and ra, is not a world of emes and sheker anymore. It's no longer a world of truth and falsehood. It's a world in which our personal desires now weigh in the equation. Before eating of the tree, man saw clearly, this is right, this is wrong. I might want that, but I see clearly that it's wrong. I know that, and that's only will I listen, will I not listen. Post-eating of the tree of knowledge, intimacy, intimate knowledge of good and bad, has now brought into man's existence where their own personal desires begin to weigh in on the equation. And besides for our trait of wanting to rebel, we have a hard time figuring out even what's right and what's wrong, because we get clouded. Someone would ask me the question whether or not it's permissible for a doctor to write a bill for $150 more, and they're not sure about it. How can they not be sure? It's so obvious to us. Well, we're not involved in it, so it's obvious to us. I can walk past the same bowl of cookies on two separate occasions and come to two totally different conclusions based on my desires. I've actually created a mitzvah because I want the cookie, so I've justified it. And now when I go through my head, should I, shouldn't I, it's not, is it good for me, is it bad for me, it's, this is really an appropriate thing for anybody to do. In fact, I'll try to get more people to stop buying and eat the cookies because I've created such a mitzvah out of it. Let's go back to our four equations. What is a true moral dilemma? A true moral dilemma is when you're in a situation in which you are caught between two competing ideals, both of which, under normal circumstances, you would always do because they are inherently correct and valid. But life has put you in a situation where they clash and you can't do both at the same time. So, for example, example number one, a man's on the respirator, dying man, he's suffering, he's old, he's begging me, please take me out of my misery. What are you struggling between? Which two boxers are in the ring with you as you try to figure out, like, well, what should I do?
Mercy.
On the one hand, mercy, personal autonomy, fulfilling the man's wishes, he's suffering. All those things under normal circumstances, would we do those things? Of course we would. Those are all good things. On the other hand, in order for me to do, be merciful, put him out of his suffering, and fulfill his wishes, what do I need to do?
Kill him.
Would we normally do that?
No.
I'm stuck in a situation where the two boxers in the ring are murder, which is a harsh way of, whatever, let's call that murder, which it is. In Jewish law, that would be 100% considered murder. Murder versus wanting to be merciful, listening to the man's request, and putting him out of his misery. Moral dilemmas created out of two competing ideals which both grab for our attention, and now, well, what do I do? Now, how would we answer that moral dilemma? So we would have a halacha, the Torah. We look into, in the hierarchy of ideals, which ideal takes precedence. But the dilemma is created out of the two competing ideals. Let's go to case number two. My elderly mother needs me and my child needs me. What are my two competing ideals that I struggle with as I try to figure out what to do with my Sunday evening? Honor my parents. Responsibility to my children. Now, under normal circumstances, they're both good and valid. Of course I want to be there for my child, and of course I want to be there for my parents. They've clashed. The same evening they both need me. That creates the moral dilemma. How do we resolve this moral dilemma? I don't know, which takes precedence? My responsibility to my... Good question. Ask your local Orthodox rabbi. I don't know. But the dilemma is created out of those two competing ideals. I do think it's your parents, by the way, but let's leave that aside for now. Billy is asked by his teacher, now any teachers in the room should never ask any other student to do this, but Billy's teacher does. What's Billy's dilemma as he stands there in front of his teacher? What's he struggling with? Telling the truth versus loyalty to his friends. He wants to be loyal. This is my buddy. I don't want to turn him in. Well, how do you handle when you want to be loyal, but being loyal will require you to lie? Or if I want to tell the truth, but requiring me to tell the truth requires me to be disloyal. Welcome to the world of moral dilemmas. Life is filled with them when you have two competing ideals that you otherwise would always hold up, and you're just stuck. Let's go to case number four. You turn around, you hear the thud, and there's a big dent in the shiny new Lexus. Should I leave a note? Should I not leave a note? Let's put the two boxes in the ring. On the one hand is
honesty.
It's the right thing to do. On the other hand is? What's the ideal on the other side of not leaving a note?
In the way.
Right? I don't want to leave a note. That's what it's called. Right? It's do the right thing versus I don't like doing the right thing. Or the right thing is going to cost me money and I don't want to pay for that which I owe even though I'm the one who did it. There aren't two boxers. It's just one. Yet, post-tree world that we live in, we actually put into the realm of moral dilemmas, we throw into that ring the types of dilemmas which really aren't dilemmas. It's only dilemmas because we want them. We make him one. When this person asked me, Rabbi, am I allowed to have the doctor do that? And we're all sitting here thinking and scratching our heads, but what are the two options? I don't understand. There's like honesty and not being honest, you're stealing. And the reason why you should be allowed to do that is because why? Yet, to the person asking me the question, he didn't see it as clearly as you do. He was like really hoping for an answer so much so to ask a question. Now his moral bearings were strong enough that he asked me the question because he clearly knew the answer that he was going to get. When our moral bearings are really weak, we don't even ask the question, we just justify it and go ahead and do it. My dilemma with the cookies is the same. As I'm sitting there the second time, I had a little debate along the way of, those really aren't good for me. And then I created something called, well, it's really a mitzvah to do. And I really could have gone into the Beis Medrash and opened up a book and read for an extra 3 minutes and also have done that in the merits of this Rebbe and accomplish the same thing. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to eat the cookie. So I created a dilemma. Now, like, mitzvah is not good for me. Mitzvah is not good for me. Mitzvah is going to win out over that every time because I'm a religious person. So those are my two choices. Go for the cookie. But I created that dilemma. That's not a real moral dilemma. Yet, post-tree world, we've actually created a situation in which we believe those two things are like that. There's an amazing statement the sages make. If you want to know what your Yetzer Hara, what the evil inclination looks like, the sages say as follows. When a person dies after 120 years and they go up to the heavens, the heavenly court will show you an image of your Yetzer Hara. It will show you exactly what it looks like. Sages say, you want to know what it looks like? Sages say, to the righteous, it will look like a mountain. And the righteous will say, oh my goodness, look at the size of that. How was I ever able to overcome it? To the wicked, the sages say, it will look like a little molehill. And they'll walk over it and they'll say, that's what I fell for? Can't believe it. It's nothing. That's what the sages say. To the righteous, it looks like a mountain. To the wicked, it looks like a molehill. Now, we would almost intuit it should have been the opposite. To the righteous who were able to defeat their inclination, it should have looked like a little molehill because they were able to defeat it. And to the wicked who always fell for it, it should appear far larger. So what's the explanation for this? So the Reformer suggests the following. Our desires are very powerful, as we all know. It changes the way that we think of things. It changes the way that we put things into the equation. But what's the feeling we get after we do it? And you see that big chocolate cake, and you walk in, and you're like, there's no way I can stop myself. That has my name on it. And then after you polish it off, 786 calories later, and you're still hungry, and now all you have in front of you is a bellyache and 4 hours in the gym, how does that cake look now? Like, I can't believe for that, like, that wasn't worth it. I ate the whole thing. Says Rabbi Foreman, the righteous never gave in to their desire. They were always able to separate it and find the right thing. So when they get up to heaven, how does it look? It still looks like that mountain. It still looks like that chocolate cake calling the name because they didn't eat it. And when you don't yet do it and you don't yet experience it, it seems so massive. It seems so tempting. How can I ever withhold myself from doing this? So the wicked who spent their whole life giving in to their desires, they have the perspective of the backseat driver, of the Monday morning quarterback saying, after that, I can't believe that wasn't worth it. And they see their evil inclination as a little molehill because they've already experienced it. And after experiencing it, it always seems far less than it really otherwise would. But this is the post-world that we live in. If you go through Eve's response, we have like 7 or 8 differences that she did. They all were along this line of how we begin the rationalization process. God said, you can eat of all the trees. And she says, yeah, we can eat of the trees. Which tree is in the middle, according to Eve? tree of knowledge. The one tree that she can't have, all of a sudden became in the center. That wasn't the one in the center, according to God, what he told us. It was the tree of life that was in the middle. But to her, it's all of a sudden in the middle. She adds, you can't touch it. Seriously, when you make things more difficult, more impossible, all like, how can I possibly be asked not to do this? Look how hard it is. I can't even do this. What will happen as a punishment? What if God said you will surely die? How do we justify things to ourselves? Well, we downplay the punishment. What does she say? We might die. Because if I'm dealing with something where God said you will surely die, it's a lot harder for me to do. But if I'm dealing with it on a level of, maybe, then it becomes a lot easier. She also pushes it off. When did God say the punishment would happen? On that day. When does she say? She leaves it out. It just might happen one day. So it all leads or lends itself towards the way that we begin when our own interests play into the equation, how we begin to see things in a little bit of a different light because of that. Okay, let's deal with the next big issue. Nakedness. Nakedness came up everywhere. Came up in the beginning of the story, the middle of the story, end of the story. The snake is defined as being Aram. Why that? So when we talk about desires entering into our being, now again, let's take a backtrack just for 1.5 seconds. The imagery that we've been speaking about this entire time is the concept of eating of a tree. Now, we didn't ask this as one of our questions, but we could have. But isn't that interesting that that's the imagery of eating something? Why is that what's chosen to define this new world order that we're about to enter into? It has like images of, like, it didn't really strike us as odd because we all grew up with Snow White. And we all know that that's what happens. You have a shiny red apple, and when you eat it, it brings with it its poison. But what isn't an interesting way of doing it? That it's when you eat of something? When you think about it, it's very powerful because what other way is there to internalize something? What imagery is there other than you are what you eat? Which is the reality. We are what we eat. It becomes literally part of us. To internalize the da'at, the tree of knowledge of good and bad, of good and evil, it's in the form of a fruit, of a tree which is literally consumed and then becomes a part of her. Now, when we bring desire into us, which is really what happened, we brought in the concept of good and bad, in which we define things not as true and false, but by good and bad. Good and bad are the types of terms in which we use our subjective understanding of things. I like it. The child says ice cream is good. We now use things to say good and bad because we are defining our own nature, our own desire is determining how we look at moral dilemmas. That powerful drive has now become part of us. This powerful drive in which our own ratzon, our own desire, our own wants now enter into the equation is represented by possibly the most powerful and creative desire that we have and the most godlike. The human sexuality, that aspect creates people, creates a human being. It's a very creative drive. It's a very powerful drive, and the reason why it's so powerful is because of the power behind it to literally create a human being, to bring a soul down into this world, is a very powerful God-like thing. We are actually partners with God every time human beings get together to create a child. When you talk about desire and passion and creativity entering into the essence of man and of woman, it's represented by that powerful drive. And most powerfully, that drive of that nakedness and its representation of sexuality. And that drive to create that powerful human emotion. Man, what's his emotional response when he realized he was naked? That which had once been a natural act, just like you eat, just like you sleep, so you procreate, it's all one and the same. And now, when man eats of the fruit, what's the first thing he notices? He's naked. And what's his emotional response? What does he say to God why he's hiding? He's afraid of it. Why is he afraid of his nakedness? What are we afraid of? Things which are bigger and more powerful than us that we're not sure how we're going to control. He's not embarrassed that he's naked. He says that he was afraid because he was naked. A reformer suggests that now that he's changed the nature of his own balance of as a person. Before he ate of the tree, he saw clearly what was right and what was wrong, and he had his own personal desires. But because it was so clear that which was right and that which was wrong, everything was in check. I'm a human being, I have desires, I have wants, but I also see clearly it's not overrunning me. When he ate of the tree, and that now clouds his vision in a way that we, as we discussed, you can now see things which really shouldn't be there, but we create them in our mind because our desire for them is so powerful. He's now sitting on top of a very powerful drive which has become part of him, and his balance is off. That perfect balance of intellect versus desire is now a little bit off kilter because his desire was just bumped up so much. He uses an example, if you try to soup up a car, your Toyota Camry, and you put a sports car engine in it, but you keep the steering wheel the same and all the shifts and gears the same, you're now driving a much more powerful car, but your tools to control it are the same as for a far less powerful engine. When you get behind that wheel and you need to drive your first carpool, and you got children in the back seat, and you got this powerful sports car engine, and you're not really sure how it's going to run, what's your feeling? You're afraid of it. What is going to be with this powerful emotion that I have? How do I control it? How do I deal with this? Because it used to be, it was sort of clear, this is my desire, this is what's right and what's wrong, and I have it all in balance, I'm all in check. And now that the desire became so much more part of me that it sort of overrun my thought process, I now not only have to deal with what Adam had to deal with about rebellion, I now got to deal with just figuring out what's right from wrong. Even that I'm not clear on anymore. And why not? Because of my own personal desires. I'm afraid of controlling this. Sages say a fascinating thing. Barasi Yetzirah, I created the evil inclination. Ubarasi Torah Tavlin. And I created Torah as its spice. So that the sages see Torah as a spice for the Yetzirah. That's a funny way of saying it, because when you say that, what's the primary and what's secondary in such an equation? If I say you have steak and spice, which one's primary and which one's secondary? Steak is primary. Nobody eats spice, but lots of people like to eat steak. But steak tastes a whole lot better with its spices. And the sages see the relationship between our inclination and Torah as that of the inclination is the primary, and the Torah is simply a spice for it. Our passions are very important. They're critical to the way that we live our life. All of our creativity is born out of that. It's not a negative thing, but it's very powerful. And it's now part and parcel. It's not just something that we have, it's something that we are. And that needs to be controlled. It needs to be harnessed. It needs to be understood so that you use it in the right way, in the right times, so that that powerful tool is not misused. And the sages are touching on that when they say, yes, I created the Yetzer Hara. It's a very powerful tool. It's got a lot of positives to it. But I created the Torah as its spice to give you the guidelines and the tools that you will need to take that powerful tool and use it appropriately and be creative and not destructive with it. Let's just finish up quickly. We're running out of time. One of the other questions we asked were is punishments. All the punishments seem to be totally random and not connected with what they did. Why is the snake, why does he lose his legs? Why does he lose his ability to speak? Why does his food not taste good anymore? The curse between him and man. Why does woman have childbirth pains? Why does man have to work the field? Why are those related to what took place over here? So again, our informant suggests the following. What we introduced into man was this very powerful desire, creativity, that passion is now part of us and it colors everything that we do. We no longer will see very clearly what's right from wrong. When we're involved, we're colored. So you always have to ask your questions to someone else outside of it because they'll see more clearly than you because we're so colored by that. When that happens and you became so colored, what is the most creative, the fundamental creative aspect of man and of woman that would have now been thrown out of whack because of this? So in woman, the most creative part is her actually creating a child. That idea of childbirth, that creative energy of being able to take a child, have it develop within her, and then give birth to it, that form of creativity gets punished because things are now out of whack. The natural order that I created things is different than it initially was and was supposed to have been. Because of that, when you live through or experience that pinnacle of creativity, it's not going to be so perfect as it once was. In the example of the car, if I create a car with absolutely no friction, perfect car, and then the manufacturer says it comes out of the shop for the first, it's absolutely no friction. How long would that car last? Forever. If there's no friction, it will never wear out. God created us in a perfect balance of intellect and passion and things we would have lived forever. When we change that balance and we introduce a very powerful aspect that used to be outside of us and then it's now become part and parcel of who we are and the balance is off, there's a lot of friction that's created. So there are a couple of things which happen. Number one, what happens to man? On the day you eat of it, you shall surely die. Because you can't live forever anymore. On the day you ate of it, you created that friction, so to speak. You created the situation that would eventually lead to death. Even though it happens 900 years later, it was put into place on the day you eat of it. And your balance with the world around you is going to be, everything is off. How will that manifest itself? When a woman gives birth to a child, it will be full of pain because things are not perfectly smooth and aligned. And man's greatest form of creativity, when he works the fields and he creates his sustenance out of that, no longer will that be so simple. You're going to have to work hard. The ground will be a curse because of you. The balance between man and the world around him, his form of creativity, any of you have ever known a man to have a little garden in his front yard, and you know how seriously we take those things of being able to create that out of nothing from the seed, out of the ground, and now something is here, and it's real, and it's tangible, and I can support myself and my family with that. And we don't live in that agricultural culture society anymore, but it's that same thing. However man goes out and earns a living, that form of creativity, not going to be so simple anymore. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat bread. We mentioned last night, no longer will you eat fruits, now you got to eat bread. You're going to have to beat your sustenance out of the earth. It's not going to be so simple as just plucking fruit out of trees and eating it effortlessly. You got to make that bread. You got to earn that living, and it's going to be tough because that balance is no longer there. It is thrown off. There's a Medrash that says that when God gave his initial punishment to man, if you notice, there were three verses in his punishment. First, God says that accursed is the ground in verse 17. Accursed is the ground because of you. Through suffering shall you eat of it. Thorns and thistles shall sprout for you, and shall eat the herb of the field. And Medrash says when God said that, Adam said, eat the herb of the field. Do you mean that I and my donkey are going to eat from the same thing? Just the herb? That's it? Like, I'm now cursed. I can't eat from the fruits of the trees of Gan Eden. I'm kicked out. There's nothing separating myself and my donkey anymore. Think about all that we said. When the Medrash says that that's what Adam's reaction was. I'm just like my animals. Put that in context. He was created on the same day. He was exalted above the animal kingdom. He was endowed with a soul, and he failed the serpent's request of listen to that inner voice, just like we do. He gets punished, and God says, now you're going to eat the herbs of the field, just like the animals. And man says, just like my donkey? And then God says in the third verse, by the sweat of your brow you will eat bread. And you're still going to be creative. You're still going to be different. You're going to have to work for it, but you're not going to just pluck stuff off the ground like the animals do. Your sustenance will be different. It'll be much more refined. It'll be the bread, and that sort of appeased Adam. That even after he failed, he still did not have that parallel with his animal kingdom. He was still above and exalted from them. Okay, what did we leave out? We didn't really talk about the fact that God is knowing of good and evil. That was the other big question that we had. Where are we holding time-wise? Almost. A couple of minutes. So, God is also defined. Remember the snake says, why does God not want you to eat? Because when you eat of it, what will happen to you? You will be like God, knowing good and evil. We said, that's a real funny definition for God. He doesn't know good and evil. So it's possible to suggest, and this you can really take or leave, you can think about it some more. But what happened, what does it mean when man ate of the tree of knowledge of good and evil? His desire, his will, his ratzon, his passion became part of him. Now for human beings, that's not necessarily a good thing. That's difficult for us to deal with. Because our passions aren't always good. But what if we were God, and our passions were all good? Wouldn't we also define God as having that internal source of passion, that internal source of creativity, that internal source of all of those desires are there. But in his world, it's all good. He looks at how do we always think when we want to pray for something? We say, "Yehi ratzon milufanecha." It should be your will, because when it's your will, it is. There's no distinction, but it's an inherent part of who he is. It's a godliness that you express your will. Now, when man has that, we became godly, but it's a problem for us because our will isn't always so godly. Our will isn't always so good. We have to deal with things that we want which aren't so good, but the nature of how we want it is now much more similar to the godly-like nature of that than it was before, even though for him it's a good thing and for us it's not necessarily. That's a suggestion as far as that goes, and I will leave with one last thought, and that has to do with God's question to man when he says, "Where are you?" So I introduced briefly last night, I apologize if I'm running through this very quickly, but I want to get this all in. On the sheet that I handed you, based on what we discussed, there were in Numbers 2 and Numbers 3 are other examples that you find of the usage of the word Epho, which means where are you, and Echa, or Aye, where are you. Both words, Epho and Aye, can be used to denote where are you. Now if you look at the couple of examples of where the Torah uses the word Epho in 2a, b, and c, tell me please, where are they shepherding? So Joseph says about his trying to find out where his brothers are. Epho heim roim, where are they shepherding? Where did you gather grain today? Naomi says to Ruth, says to Rus, Epho lakita hayom, where did you gather? Epho Shmuel v'David, where are Samuel and David? What does the word Epho imply? Very simple location. Where was it? The word Aye, listen to the way we find examples of Aye. A man dies, and then where is he? Vayigva Odom v'ayo. Where is he? Is there an answer to that question?
No.
That's a theoretical, philosophical question. A man dies, and he's not here anymore. Where is he? Hinei ha'esh, aye ha'seh lo'olah. Yitzhak says to his father Avram as they're on their way to the Akedah, he's on his way to be bound. And he's walking with his father for 3 days. And all of a sudden it occurs to Isaac, well, you have a knife, and you have wood, and you got the rope, and there's no animal in sight, and you don't seem to be looking for one. And he asks his father, where's the animal? In that word, where, he's not asking for the location, it's already an understanding of where is it? It's not here. What's the ramification of that? Aye no Eloheihem, where are their gods? Rhetorical question. They're not here. Where are they? To their mothers, starving children will say, where is the grain and the wine? They're not asking for a location. There is none. And they're asking, where is it? When Hashem says to Adam, Ayeka, is he asking, hey Adam, looking around the garden, and I don't see you anywhere. Where are you? It's not what he's asking. It's not even the words that he uses. He's asking, where are you? Where have you gone? The person who I left here a few moments ago is not that person anymore. I know exactly where you are, but it's more of a rhetorical, philosophical question. Where have you gone? I will conclude with the Medrash. Tonight, as we've been speaking, crossed into the 17th of the month of Tammuz, the beginning of the 3 weeks where we mourn the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, both of the temples destroyed 3 weeks from today. The word Ayeka, where are you, is the same spelling as the word Echa, which is a lament. At the beginning of the book of Echa begins, as we'll read on Tisha B'Av. The Medrash says that when Hashem asks Adam, where are you? He's also really saying an Echa. He's also lamenting what has happened to mankind, that I gave you this one command for you to accept my rulership, to accept me as king, and you failed, and the ramifications of that are all that has just taken place, and I now need to expel you from Gan Eden. I brought Adam into the Garden of Eden and commanded him. He transgressed my commands, and I had to decree exile upon him, the Medrash says. And upon his departure, I lamented Ayeka. Echa, what happened? I lament that this is not what I had intended for mankind. And then the Medrash says, and connects us right to, so it was with his children. The same pattern that was created by Adam was followed by his children. I brought them into the land of Israel and commanded them, and they transgress my commands, I decree exile upon them in the same way I decree exile upon man, and upon their departure, once again lamented, Eicha. How has this happened? This is our task, to get us back to the state that we were in the Garden of Eden, to have our ideals in order, to have our perspectives in order, to use these 3 weeks of mourning to understand that all, to use that as a chance to get in line with how many of the decisions we make are affected by our own passions. This is the life we live. Everyone who's lived post-Adam has this struggle of our own passions, which burn so powerfully within us, a part of who we are and what we do, and to align them with the real, the truth, and the sheker of the world that we once lived within, despite the fact that we now live in a world of tov and ra, good and bad, and to make all of our appropriate decisions within that. Thank you for listening. I hope you all enjoyed, and there are, I'm sure, more questions left that I have not answered, but it's good to be that way. A great evening.